We all set. All right, guys. Welcome to This Juan Time. Today, my guest is the very powerful Liz Frisius.
Frisius.
I know her through the stand-up comedy world. We worked at Game Show Bad Rooms a few times, and she's a booker, promoter, performer, and voice acting. I mean, you name it. She's retired from military. She's your all-around badass. Liz, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you very much. I just want to, let's just get into it. I know you through comedy. So how did you find comedy in this later venture? And maybe what was your first, like, you know, comedic experience as a younger individual?
Oh, lovely. Well, I grew up with comedy. My parents were much older. So I actually grew up with the vaudevillians.
Okay.
And grew up loving the Marx Brothers and Burns and Allen.
Yeah.
And had always enjoyed it, but never thought about doing it as a career.
Likewise, yeah.
So what brought you into it? What got you in? You said you never thought of doing it as a career.
I didn't. I always loved it. Would recite comedy to, you know, all my friends. I remember now, like, looking back, I would go to this website. I totally forgot what it was, but just spend hours on end when we first got AOL and just look up jokes. But, you know, I never considered myself the funny guy. I was never the one, like, at parties and get-togethers, like, holding court, making everybody laugh. I'm funny, like, I'm good in, you know, back and forth exchanges and just creating funny conversational, you know, humor and whatnot. But yeah, never was like, yeah, I'm funny where people are gonna pay money to see me. But I started podcasting and here I'm talking, and I just wanted another avenue to express some thoughts and ideas and just some, I don't know, philosophical exercises, really. Honestly, that's hey, have you guys thought about this before and make it funny, you know, where it's entertaining? Because the best conversationalists and speakers bring a humor element to what the message that you're trying to get across. That's how you connect best with people, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, my husband and I had gone to comedy shows. We started dating. We met in the Air Force Academy. We started dating there. Nice. And our dating literally was going to the comedy club on weekends. So we always enjoyed it. And he and I have been married for 31 years now.
Wow. Congrats.
Thank you so much. He's a wonderful guy. He puts up with me.
I was going to say he's pretty amazing, sounds like.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Just messing.
But he took me out one time. We were stationed out in Washington, D.C. This would have been probably 2014. And he took me out to a comedy show at the Comedy Stop in just north of D.C. in a place called Annandale. And they do the usual improv. It was an improv show. And they did the usual, we're not going to drag you on stage. We're not that type of a show. Yeah. We'll ask your input. Well, 10 minutes of me being a smart mouth when the responses, they dragged me on stage and kept me for the rest of the show.
Oh, shoot.
And it created a monster.
Yeah. I bet you got bit, right?
Oh, yeah.
With that bug. You know, it's like golf. If you've ever played, I fell in love with it over COVID, but it is literally like fail. One time, one thing goes kind of how you wanted it to. And it's like, yeah, I'm hooked.
Yep.
And that's stage time, baby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That one moment where, and the strange thing is my instincts are more geared to improv than they are to stand up, but stand up is my love. So
yeah,
that's what I do.
Oh, interesting. So you're not leaning into like what would almost necessarily become more easy to you, right? You want to put in some of the work and figure out the angle on that. That's interesting. That makes sense though. That makes sense. I see it.
It's always been the question. Do you do what's easy for you, what you're good at, or do you do what you love and you're going to struggle with?
Yeah.
And there's pros and cons to each.
For sure. So have you done improv a lot though? Or
I did improv with Brian Kahatsu. He's an absolute incredible improv instructor. Yeah. Just fantastic guy. And did improv with him and did a few other improv classes. I do Timprov now out of New York on via Zoom.
Okay.
And it is a great way of expanding perspectives. You know, when you look at, if you've ever seen the movie The Untouchables, and he talks about, you know, Al Capone gets up and talks about, you know, here's the baseball team. If you're at bat, you're the stand-up. This is individual achievement.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you're in the field, this is improv.
Oh,
this is all about the team. So it's that shift. Are you doing teamwork or are you doing individual?
Yeah, that's a very good analogy. I definitely like that. You've brought up Zoom a couple times, and I'm very adverse to that. Like, I didn't even do this podcast Zoom. The one exception was my friends, the Upper Strata, a rock group, indie psychedelic rock. I don't even know how to describe that. Doesn't even describe them. They're all over the place. Uh-huh. But they're in Switzerland, in Basel, and they're like, "Hey, we want to come on your podcast, promote our latest album. Like, can we do it, you know, over Skype?" I think it was. And I was like, "Ugh, okay." And I hadn't done it because nobody wanted to do face to face because we're in the heart of COVID.
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Yeah, let's do it." But I, you know, my mind is like, "Oh, that doesn't sound appealing to me." But what are some benefits that I'm missing out of, or just something that I haven't thought of that could, you know, maybe give me some extra skills by participating in something that I'm opposed to right out the gate?
Well, the big thing is obviously during COVID, Skype and Zoom, we adapt and overcome. Mm-hmm. Humans adapt and overcome. We're going to find a way of connection.
Yeah.
We're going to find a way to communicate with each other. And in this case, stand-up comedy, most of the clubs were closed. That's where, you know, that's where the comedy went.
Yeah.
So people could actually enjoy comedy in their homes after they'd gone through all the Netflix special.
Yeah.
From a different perspective on Zoom, if you ever aspire to do TV work, Zoom is single camera.
Okay.
You know, it's not the three camera, but this is experience dealing with cameras. Mm-hmm. Now, so if you're wanting to go on, how do you connect to your audience through a camera?
That is true, yeah.
So how do you get that impact, that feel like, no, I'm actually there with you, even though I'm on a movie set, I'm on a TV, you know, screen,
yeah,
whatever it is. How do you connect with your audience?
That is true. And that is one of the things that also has held me back from like doing any solo episodes. I've done maybe three or four solo episodes, but they were, the first one was my first episode, so that was like, yeah, let's just do that. And then my second solo one was talking about my first experience with hitting stand-up and trying an open mic for the first time. And then my most recent one was talking about my DUI. So obviously I don't need people for for that. But it does definitely feel weird, like just looking into like a lens and you're like, is anybody there? I'm so used to this that... Yes. That it just seems weird. So now that it's being asked of me, because I was asking who your agent was, because I did recently sign with a talent and modeling agency.
Nice.
So I should.
Congratulations.
I'm getting some, you know, some leads, but nothing's been booked yet. Hopefully when my headshots come in like the next week. But that is something that I do need to work on. So very, I'm gonna add that one.
Another thing to consider, networking. Networking,
yes.
Because you've got audiences all over. One of the things about being, I'm basically a very low level road comic at the moment. And in the old days, you know, when you look at vaudeville, you had to travel town to town to town to town to build a following. Road comics still do that.
Yes.
But with Zoom, now you can connect. I've got a bit of a following out in India.
All right, Liz, I'm sold already. I'm so done. Networking and in the camera. All right, but continue.
You can now reach out. You know, I had a host over in India, and he asked me one day, he says, you know, I was one of two female comics on the lineup. Obviously, cultural differences between here and India.
Yeah.
And he told me afterwards, he says, I sat there and wondered, what can she possibly talk about that would be relevant in India?
Yeah.
You have a military woman out of the United States. She's culturally inappropriate in the United States.
Yeah.
What is she going to say here? So, you know, we talked to, you know, my set that night because I had to think about it. What is relevant in India that I can possibly say comedically?
Yeah.
So I talked about, you know, the struggle between my mother-in-law and I.
Ah, yeah, there you go.
You know, the question of, okay, for a husband, is he going to be a husband first, or is he going to be the mother's son first? And it matters for what culture you grow up in.
Yeah, that is very true. And that's something that everybody would have to deal with. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what you're looking to find, right? When you come to, you know, your comedic work or a lot of our performances, how can we reach the masses and paint, you know, have the biggest strokes to reach the most people that they're like, okay, yeah, I can relate to this. And then there's moments where you do want to just go into your niche, you know, like very, you know, where it really hits with, you know, a handful of people. That is a very good point. So are you going to India soon?
Not anytime soon.
Yeah.
I've done comedy overseas before, mm-hmm. and that's, I did it in Ireland, and a musician dragged me out of the bar afterwards.
For?
Took offense at my set, because at the time it was a very new comic. I was doing some very poor material, but mm-hmm. I talked about terrorism. Mm-hmm. Having been a military member, I talked a lot about terrorism in my set. And she pulled me outside, absolutely offended, because I had failed to empathize with the terrorists.
Oh, my God. Yes. How dare you?
Well, and that actually, she brought up a good point. She'd cussed me out, and I looked at her, and she says, "You're taking this awful well." I said, "Well, you're a senior entertainer. You have a perspective and an opinion. Why wouldn't I show you the courtesy of hearing you out?"
Yeah.
And she looks at me and says, "You want to go get a beer?"
Nice. So,
comedy is a point of connection. Can we mm-hmm. open up the issues? Can we look at it? Can we shine that light where it's not been shown? Yeah. So when I came back, I became a member of the NRA because San Francisco declared all members of the NRA to be terrorists. Nice. So I joined the NRA to become a terrorist.
Dang.
And I was walking, they sent me this little duffel bag, has NRA embroidered on the side, and I'm carrying it through the airport one day. And this is one where I wish I had learned to keep my mouth shut.
Ooh, okay.
Lady stops me in the middle of the airport. I'm minding my own business. And she stops me. She says, "Do you get extra security screening for that?" I said, "This?" I said, "Oh, you're not going to believe this. I'm a stand-up comic. I joined the NRA to become a terrorist because I got dragged out of a bar in Ireland for doing jokes about terrorism." And I saw the look on her face, and I wished I had just kept my mouth shut, because I would have had a whole new comedy set right there.
Yeah, man. That's perfect. I joined the NRA to become a terrorist. That's crazy. So you were living in San Francisco for a bit?
No, actually, San Francisco had come out. Now, when you look at who can declare a terrorist group, that's the federal government's job. But in mm-hmm. this case, the city decided they were going to.
Of course.
So there was a lot of discussion going on. My husband is actually a pilot. He was a military pilot. Now he's a civilian pilot. Uh-huh. And so the discussion was going at the airlines. Can you be a member of the NRA and an airline pilot and fly into San Francisco?
What? Oh, gotcha. Okay. I'm like, wait, you can't be an NRA member and a pilot, but fly into San Francisco if they labeled them a terrorist.
Yes.
Interesting.
And so we had been talking about that, and that became the big laugh, because the city does not have the authority to declare a group a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
That's the purview of the federal government. But they tried it. It caused a lot of laughter, but...
It's a lot of headaches standing up for your own, rights. And that's why, a lot of people are just like, "Oh, okay, I guess I'll just give in," right?
Yeah.
I give in.
Most people don't realize when they're handing in rights.
Yes, that's the big thing.
And if you look at, let's take COVID, for example. I know it exists, had it. Mm-hmm. I had it in December 2019, almost killed me.
Oof.
And I look at... I always wondered how World War II, being a military member, I always wondered in World War II how Nazis managed to take over. And then you realize, what do people do when they're scared? What do people do when they're scared? Mm-hmm. Most people go straight to compliance.
Yeah.
And then you'll have a group that will go to compliance, but will also scream and yell at anybody else who's not complying mm-hmm. because they're terrified.
Yeah.
So you've got very human reactions going on here. And how do you stand in the face of that? Because it's not comfortable.
It's not.
It is not comfortable. How do you stand in the face of that? I told my husband, I work at a garden. I'm a gardener now. And I told my husband when the 2 weeks to flatten the curve, if you read the entire document, you were allowed to go take care of animals. If you were a farmer, gardener, whatever, you mm-hmm. had to go water plants, whatever, you could actually, leave.
Yeah.
And I looked at it. And I said, okay, I've got the authority to leave technically, but I'm not going to give up my rights. I'm not going to be placed under house arrest without due process of law.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at my husband and told him, get ready to bail me out of jail, because I'm probably going to get arrested. And you look at that nowadays, 2024, that seems insane.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that that was actually a discussion.
Yeah.
When you look at the sheriffs in Arizona going... No, we're not going to arrest people for going out.
Yeah.
This is against the Constitution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Constitution does not guarantee safety.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people want it to.
Yeah. Well, they want that, you know, like a sky daddy or somebody that's in charge or somebody that's like, they're deferring to authority. Yeah. Listen, I'm one that has definitely always erred on the side of authority. You know, maybe I should have been a little bit more rebellious here, you know, a few times in my life, but I get it. When COVID hit, I was in my workout group for like about a year and a half, 2 years. And we worked out together in groups out at public parks. Mm-hmm. And I remember we would get pushback from the rangers out there all the time where it's like, you guys aren't allowed to be here, like throwing everything at us. We're like, we're out here for free. Nobody's being charged anything. You know, we're out here on our own volition. But it was weird for people. Like, you guys are still getting together. I was like, we're outside. What more? Like, and we're trying to maintain our fitness level so we can be as healthy as we can. And not only that, we're maintaining friendships and fellowship, which is the big thing that you know, led a lot of people into depressive states. Yeah. Is removing the social aspect of we're social beings.
Well, when you look at comedy, mm-hmm. what bigger form of rebellion than a comic?
Yeah.
Because in comedy, you can laugh at anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can laugh at, if I don't know if you've ever heard of the, it was at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And it was a play that was done. It was actually a musical, Jihad the Musical.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And the strangest thing about it was the producers of the show went in with a premise that anything that terrifies people need to be laughed at.
It needs to, yeah.
You know, how do you take the fear out of it? How do you get people to not be controllable? If you can make them laugh at something, if they can take a different perspective, if you can open the aperture and let them see there's something else here. This is not a one solution.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they had a fatwa issued against them. They have a death threat that was waged against them. But here are ladies and gentlemen who were willing to create a play to laugh at this. And what it was the premise was a young man who was not a proponent of extremism.
Uh-huh.
He wanted the notoriety. He wanted the recognition. He wanted the money, the fame, the fortune. And that's what he did. So he breaks out into this song and dance called I Want to Be Like Osama.
Nice.
And they've got a group of ladies in pink burqa kicking in unison.
Where can I watch this?
It's on YouTube.
It is on YouTube.
Jihad the Musical, and look up I Want to Be Like Osama.
Nice. I would, if it's on YouTube, so then there's no depiction of Muhammad then, right?
No, not in that one. Well, actually, if you go back to South Park, the original South Park, there was not an issue. There are episodes of South Park that had Muhammad draw.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once again, when you look at the, when you look at how critical is humor to dealing with the world.
Yeah.
You know, you probably remember the murder of at Charlie Hebdo, the French comedy magazine.
Oh, yes, that's right.
You know, and you look at that and go, okay, ladies and gentlemen, what are you willing to do for your art?
Mm-hmm.
How important is what you're doing? How important is your message?
Yeah.
You know, and obviously some comics do it to greater or lesser degree.
Mm-hmm.
What is comedy? What truly is comedy?
Yeah, it should push the boundaries. It's, I mean, part of what humor is acknowledging that something's funny, even though it shouldn't be, it wouldn't be said in like a normal environment, you know, like, yeah. Okay, like that is something wild to say, but it's for the sake of, you know, not just shock value, you know, there's, because that gets old.
Yeah.
But it needs to be delivered in an eloquent and thoughtful way. And at that point, yeah, anything, in my opinion, can be made funny, can be made fun of. If you can't laugh at something that holds too much power over you, I definitely agree with all of that.
Well, take a look at the comedy club. Why is a comedy club? Think about it. This is something that a lot of people don't think about. You walk into a comedy club. It's small.
Mm-hmm.
It's dark.
Low ceilings, packed in.
Yep, low ceilings, packed in. You've got the sound of it. You've got the comic on stage in the spotlight. This person, it is, you know, going back to William Faulkner, this is the tale told by the idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. But does it? When you look at the court jester may have been a point of humor,
yeah,
but it was also a point of wisdom.
Yep.
This was an advisor.
Mm-hmm.
When you go into the comedy club, it's dark. Why? Because people can't see you laughing. There goes the social censure that you can't laugh at that. You can't say that.
Yeah.
You got the target who's saying the stuff, and you've got the audience who is now free to laugh at it.
Wow, that's true.
I got a hard lesson in audience. It was my very first show. It was Comedy Hijacked out of Nashville, down at Miss Kelly's in Printer's Alley. And we had, it was, obviously it's a college town. And so you've got all these young ladies and gentlemen in their early 20s. And it was not a totally dark comedy club. And every time I told a joke, I would watch the young man look at the young ladies and see if they had approval to laugh at it.
Oh.
And if the girl was laughing, the guy would laugh. If the girl wasn't laughing, they weren't going to laugh.
And they weren't, huh?
It's like, okay, I got a lesson in human nature right about that.
For sure. Well, I guess that's the whole premise of like ladies' nights and ladies drink for, you know, a dollar and... that's like, do you like Justin Timberlake? No, I don't like Justin Timberlake. Well, do you like girls? Cool. Do girls like Justin Timberlake? Well, you better know a little something about Justin Timberlake, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you have to. And that's why, you know, women do wield a lot of power in that sense, because a lot of the decisions that men make are for the interest of women.
Yeah. Young men young men have their interest. And how do you go about it? By being interested in what the...
It is so funny. But as a guy, it's, well, and now as an older guy, it's like, man, just lean into yourself. And if that person isn't on board with that, and, you know, it doesn't mean that they have to like every aspect of you, but they can A, tolerate it or work around it or just know that there's compromises, then that person is just not for you, right?
Yep.
Man.
You're finding people that not necessarily the same interests, but complementary interests or you know, the same passion level for what they do.
Yeah, same passion level for what they do is good. I like that. And also, like, not that they have to have a full interest in what you are interested in, but that they have an appreciation and a respect for it and will allow you to, you know, take it as far as you will.
Yeah. And when you look at art forms, you know, comedy as an art form.
Oh, yeah.
Versus comedy as, you know, why do we do comedy?
Yeah.
I asked this on Facebook the other day. Why does somebody do comedy?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you go into comedy?
Yeah, I just wanted another avenue to just, not even just another avenue, like probably the most freeing and public avenue to display ideas and thought processes and mind exercises. Like, you know, have you thought about this? Because it's just perspectives up there. We can all talk about the same. I can talk about my mother-in-law. You can talk about yours. And our stories will be different. Mm-hmm. They'll have very few overlapping, you know, aspects of it. But it's going to be a different perspective. Well, for one, because I'm a dude. I'm a Mexican dude, you know. But just in general, like, that's a completely different personality than my mother-in-law, right? So I never, like... Where if somebody's like, oh, don't you have a bit about that? Yeah, I don't care. I don't care. Can I continue to write? Can I continue to think? Cool. Yeah, we're going to move on. We're going to proceed. And anyways, like, it's my, you know, perspective. But I did ask Jethwan had asked me, you know, what I liked the most about it or what I found the most fulfilling or something like that. But I had just responded that I think it's just complete freedom up there, complete freedom to go where I want, how long I want to talk about a subject. Like, you have that avenue. She said it was kind of opposite. She's like, as a black female comic, I can't talk about sex. I can't, you know, be, you know, I can't be black enough. I'm not white enough. I have a white voice. I have this. So to her, you know, she was mentioning these things, which is true. Mm-hmm. You know, I can see that. But that's what I get out of it. It's just complete free. And I can literally go up there and just say what I want. Because I was in a blues band. And anytime I suggested to play a song, he's like, oh, that's not kind of what we're doing. And I'm just like, okay. Right now, nobody can tell me that. Nobody can say, well, that's not kind of what we're going. No, I'm gonna do this. Which is one of my main questions when I signed with that agency. I'm like, hey, I do comedy and I have a podcast. Are you going to tell me what I can't talk about? They're like, no, that's on you. And I'm like, cool. I had a list of like seven questions, and I kind of expected them just to be like, you know, do you want to sign or not? You know, we got other candidates. But no, they took the time. So that showed the professionalism and that they were serious about their investment in me. And but that last question was like, this is a big one. I got this, this, and this. Like, are you going to infringe on any of that? And they told me no. And I was like, okay, cool. I'll go ahead and proceed.
And that actually is, that's huge, because when you look at what are we willing to give up?
Mm-hmm.
What are we willing to give up? What is the goal? What is the path? Doing that question recently about, you know, why did somebody go into comedy? And I've found everything from looking for a sense of community. It's just what I do on a weekend night. Some people go bowling. I go do comedy. There are those who go, I want to take this all the way.
Yeah.
There are those who go, I want a Netflix special. You know, how do we define success?
Yeah, sure.
How do we define success? For somebody, success is they were able to stand up at that microphone and say their name. Mm-hmm. And that's all mm-hmm. they wanted to do. We had one young man out of Nashville. He was a PhD student, mechanical engineering PhD student. He said if he could master stand-up comedy, he could speak on any stage in the world mm-hmm. with confidence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
His goal was the confidence that doing stand-up comedy successfully would bring. There are those who go, you know what? This is my calling. This is my profession. I want nothing more than to make a living at stand-up comedy. I've had those who have said, you know what? This was a way of dealing with all my childhood trauma, all the pain. And so how do people define success? The why is important, because that'll tell you the how.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are you doing this? It's to fulfill a goal, a need, something.
Yeah, and it is something that you need to line out for yourself and put your finger on. Otherwise, you'll just keep spinning and you'll never know when you're there and when you're like, okay, I'm successful. Everything out of here is kind of the cherry on top. Like this is what success has meant in my eyes, and I'm there. And now it's like, because again, if that person's whole goal was just to be comfortable in front of people, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. You got that. But if they didn't define that and they were just like looking at the guy next to them, were like, well, they're getting booked. They got a Netflix special. They got this. They got that. Like, why don't I have that? You know, then there comes in the line of thinking where it's like, you know, you don't feel your worth at that point.
Yeah.
So defining your level of success and what that looks for you is very important. I'd agree.
It's interesting. You brought up, you know, people saying, you know, why don't I have X, Y, or Z? And it's obviously a conversation in the comedy community. Why is it that people get so upset when someone has success?
Yeah.
Why don't we celebrate that?
Mm-mm.
And, you know, we're getting better at that, obviously. But the shouting out when people do something good, in the military, we used to call it catch somebody doing something right. It's easy to catch somebody screwing up. It's easy to catch somebody having a bad day. It's easy to see all that. But how do we celebrate someone's achievements?
Can you imagine if we created that culture of like pointing out when people are doing great? Because then they'll promote them. I want to get called out for doing great.
Yeah. And you look at, you know, we've got in the Phoenix comedy scene, we've got ladies and gentlemen who are making significant moves.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Michael Longfellow out on Saturday Night Live. You've got Mary Upchurch out in Las Vegas. You've got Rayla Earle out in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. You've got Celia Contreras, Kiltony, out in Austin. We had a group of comics just move out to Austin. Mm-hmm. We've got Aldo Campagna just moved up to New York.
Yeah.
You've got Tristan Bowling out in New York.
Yeah.
These are ladies and gentlemen making significant moves in their comedy careers, in their comedy path. And why aren't we celebrating those achievements?
Yeah.
Those achievements and going, okay, ladies and gentlemen, if this is truly what you want, it's one thing. If you want to come out and do open mic on Wednesday, beautiful. We've got that. But if you want to make this a comedy path, guess what? Here's the long laugh line. Here's the long laugh line going from here all the way to LA, New York, Austin, or on the road. Here are the ladies and gentlemen that you can talk to. Here are the ladies and gentlemen you can network with.
Mm-hmm.
Here's who you can talk to about what is it like to take these steps? What do I need to consider? You know, am I ready to go? What should I be thinking about? What are some decisions I need to make?
Yeah.
How do I set myself up for success and not failure?
Yeah. Because, I mean, there are blueprints. There's a ton of blueprints out there, but also, like, the guiding principles and making those connections on who you can talk to help you to get to the next level, to get to the next stage of your career. But how long before, you know, Phoenix is a hub in comedy of itself?
Actually, the strange thing is when I moved from Nashville, because I retired from the military and literally I was on terminal leave. I had actually, after I went to that improv show, I had done one open mic in Washington, D.C. It was at Politics and Prose. And I realized that I better table the dream of doing comedy so I don't get court-martialed.
Oh, nice.
So I set it to the side. I put it on the back burner while I did the rest of my Air Force career.
Yeah.
And then when I retired, I was on terminal leave, which is the last bit of time off that you have before you're fully out of the military.
Okay.
And I walked in and walked onto the comedy stage. Been there ever since. Nashville is more of a music. It's, yes. It's very much a music town.
Yeah.
And so the odd thing was Phoenix was already viewed as a bit of a hub. Now, what is it going to take to make it the next great comedy city? Everybody knows about L.A. and New York.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard about the rise of Austin.
Yeah.
You've heard about, you know, okay, what about Chicago? What, you know, is Chicago more of an improv town? Is it more of a stand-up town?
Yeah.
Are, you know, looking at Las Vegas, what is going to be the next great comedy city?
I think we're very poised to have that. It's just, Phoenix is so weird because I've been in bands since, you know, I've worked at Guitar Center for the last, you know, 15 years. And it's definitely always troubling that, like, a lot of local acts don't get bigger. And something to do about the support around here isn't ideal. And I think there's a few factors. The no tolerance, you know, everywhere you go, there's going to be a drink. And it's like, well, do I drink my one? Because if I have my one and drive, then I could, you know, face some consequences from there, right? So obviously that's on people's minds. But also how spread out we are, right? We don't really grow up like a lot of the other cities. We're very spread. So I think those are the two main factors that kind of play into it. But also it's like, I think we have to build a little bit more of a community feel where it's like, where there's tangible support. I think that's the biggest part that is missing to get people enticed to come out and see shows. And maybe that has to do with a lot of our quality. Maybe us as comics, we need to, you know, step up our quality content and to, and I guess I'm speaking to myself because that's one of my main aims in life and my career is to become undeniable. Mm-hmm. Undeniable. Like for the contest that we were in the other day, right?
Yes.
Where, you know, I was like, okay, I might have ran the light. Okay, I didn't get the greatest laughs. I thought I might have been on stage. As soon as they announced that there was three dudes on stage, I was like, oh, there's no way. I was like, there's no way. You know, and your mind goes there. But, you know, my hat's off to everybody, what you guys are doing to put on and all that. And then I get home and I smoke a little weed. And then I go, oh, wait. That one bit that I wanted to say, because I really like on how the UK spent, you know, so much of its, you know, power getting herbs and spices and then doesn't use it in their cuisine. And that's like a woman finding the perfect man, but he's gay. Like that's my get to, right? But in there, I have an Asian stereotype joke after the show was promoted to have the opportunity to go to Hong Kong to open up for a Chinese comic. And then here I have is a stereotype about Asians in my thing. And so I was like, that could have also played a factor in it. But, you know, if I had that crowd, you know, laughing off of their seats, and even if that was one of the factors that kept me off the winning stage, like, you would expect that the crowd would be like, hey, hold on. Why isn't this guy on it? You need to become undeniable. So my sense is I take my loss. I congratulate all the winners. I congratulate the promoters and we're on to the next one.
And here's the thing. What are competitions really good for? It tells you so much about yourself as a comic.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you so much about yourself as a comic.
Yeah.
And you know, I had a strange situation the other day. I was out at Mic Drop. And nothing nefarious, nothing bad. And one of the comics came up and asked me in all sincerity if I had ever been shot.
Okay.
And this was right prior to the start of the comedy competition.
Okay. Were you performing?
I was. And this was one where one of the other veterans had said, hey, that's not something you talk about.
Yeah.
And the person very honestly said, no, I'm seeking information. And the person was very sincere, very, very sincere. Mm-hmm. But I realized that for me, going on stage like that, I walked on stage in a very bad mindset.
Yeah.
And it was a, okay, I've learned something about myself. There's a point where this conversation has to be compartmentalized. Now it's time to bring the funny.
Yeah.
I'm not here to be in my own head. I'm here to make the audience laugh.
Yes.
So I learned something about myself, and probably a good thing to know before going on stage. They find a way to get yourself in the mindset that you are here giving a gift to your audience.
Yeah.
And you were talking about being undeniable. When I see comics that are having a fit about, I should have gotten X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand. It's disappointing. I understand. There are days when something did or didn't go on, something should or shouldn't have happened, whatever. There's a million different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? Grab the bootstraps. Let's go. There's another competition coming up.
There's so many, too.
Let's get ready for it. When you look at... you know, you're talking about Phoenix is more spread out. We don't grow up, we go out. There's a point of ownership. And I'm being clear as mud here, but I love what Mary Upchurch did.
Mm-hmm.
She went out to a competition in L.A. It might have been a show, but I think it was a competition she was on out in L.A., and somebody walked over and with one of those, you know, backhanded compliments said, oh, you're Phoenix funny.
Ooh.
And she trademarked it.
Okay. I love that.
She trademarked it.
I love that.
She owned it and went, yeah, I'm Phoenix funny and Phoenix is bringing it. So what are you going to do?
Bang.
Yeah. Own it.
Yes.
And that's where, okay, we're going out into New York, Austin, L.A., are we proud of being a Phoenix comic? Are we proud of our Phoenix roots?
Mm-hmm.
How many of us go, yeah, I'm from Phoenix. No, I'm from Phoenix and I'm damn proud of it.
Yeah.
Because Phoenix will build you. Look at the talent that comes out of Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
Look at who's been nominated for Emmys. Who's been, you know, Celia Contreras will tell you flat out her goal, her stated goal in comedy is to be the recipient of the Mark Twain Award. The highest accolade our nation can give for stand-up comedy presented at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
That is her stated goal. And she says, I am proud of being a Phoenix comic. Mary Upchurch, that one lady gives her that backhanded compliment and she turns around and goes, yeah, bitch, guess what? I am Phoenix funny and I'm proud of it.
Yeah, I love that.
There's the flip. There's the twist.
Yeah.
There's the twist to it. Be proud of who you are. You know, did I bomb a show the other day? Yeah. Am I proud of having made it to the semifinals? Yes.
Yes.
Why? Because that's a step further than I've ever done before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. Is my comedy where it should be? No, it's not. I will openly tell you, it's not. Am I embarrassed by it? Yeah, it's time for me to do something about that. What does it tell me? If I'm sitting there going, why did I not? Because I didn't put the work in.
Because, yeah, you haven't put enough in. Yeah.
I have not put in the work. I have not solved. My timing is terrible. I need to do something about my timing. Mm-hmm. If I want to go further, I have to fix the problem. I can't ignore it.
Yeah.
Because what happens when you're going up for, you know, you're going up in front of a crowd of 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, oh yeah, I never fixed that problem back here.
Yeah.
Everybody wants, you know, everybody wants to be the young, brilliant whiz kid.
Yeah.
The problem that I've seen with that military government agency university I worked at, and even in stand-up comedy, people want the young, brilliant whiz kid. They build them a mile tall with an inch-wide foundation, and the slightest breeze will topple them.
Yeah.
So are we building the solid foundations? Are we demanding of ourselves that we build a solid foundation so we can withstand whatever hits us?
Yeah, you do. It's like the martial arts side of things where it's like you start out as a white belt. We're going to drill these basic, you know, movements until you got them in. I love that Mary Upchurch line. That reminds me of a Squid. She's a local R&B singer and pianist. And I had her on because I had heard where I was at her show. And she's like, people ask me, you know, where my name comes from, you know, Squid. She, you know, she's Filipino. And she's like, well, I went to an all white school when we first transferred up here, and they knew I was, you know, Filipino. And so they use it to insult me that I ate squid and this and that. She changed, like, you know, the way it's spelled and all that. But she's like, so I took that name and owned it. And I was like, come here. Like, let me yeah. talk to you and see what's in that mind, because that is you can just succumb to that, mm-hmm. or you can take it and be like, I'm going to reverse what you are trying to inflict on me and make it bring me power. That's amazing. So on that question that you got asked before your show, hindsight now, would you say, hey, I would love to answer that, but not now? Or would you still answer it, but then just be like, okay, I know I need to, like, whoosh.
You know, probably the better solution on that. We used to joke in the military, and my military instincts have not quite transferred over to my comedy ones
yeah,
yet.
Yeah.
Because they used to say that the most important thing you're ever going to hear, your schedule will be booked to the hilt. And one of your young troops will come up and go, ma'am, do you have a moment? It's not important. The moment somebody tells you it's not important, that is probably the most important thing you're going to hear all day.
Gotcha.
But you've got to go take care of whatever it is that, and the correct solution for that is, listen, I have a mandatory appointment right now, but I want to hear this. So I should be back by X time. Can you come back at that time? Mm-hmm. Because I want to hear this. This is important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's one where I probably should have said, you know what? Let's grab a cup of coffee. We'll talk about it later. That would have been the better solution, you know, looking at it hindsight. And there's the other question for comedy. How many times do we go through something, but we don't think about it?
Yeah.
You know, it's something's hit and you just go, okay. And you move on.
Yeah. Every day of my life, Liz.
But how often do we stop and go, okay, what just happened? You know, what went well? What didn't go so well? What would I do different if I encountered that circumstance again?
Mm-hmm.
What would I do differently next time, where now that is handleable? That's something that I can actually, you know, I've got a better solution for it. We used to talk about the 80-20 rule in the military.
Mm-hmm.
Give me an 80% solution. Execute aggressively and mitigate the other 20%. It'll get you through most things.
Yeah.
But, you know, you were talking about, you know, loving the owning it. In the military, there was a concept called a nom de guerre, a war name. And the highest war name you could ever be given was by your enemy.
Ah.
And probably...
chills.
Probably the best known one that most people would recognize nowadays was Margaret Thatcher being named the Iron Lady by the Russians.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She thought it was hilarious. She took it, she owned it, she ran with it.
Yeah.
You know, how often do we get named something by our adversaries?
Yeah.
You know, how often do we get accused of stuff by an adversary and you just go, yeah, and your point?
Your point is, yeah.
So, you know, she was the Iron Lady. She owned it. She ran with it. Squid owned it and went, yeah, guess what? I've got a path of success,
mm-hmm.
and you're not going to stop me.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Powerful ladies, powerful ladies. What got you into the military then? Was it something that you had aspired to? So I'll tell you real quick, because people ask me too. It's like, why didn't I serve? And in hindsight, there is a little bit of regret that, you know, I don't have a stronger sense of patriotism, you know, to my country. I mean, my parents came here as not citizens, you know, and then they became naturalized, but I was born here. So yeah, there's a lot of me is still, you know, I love Mexico. I love all that, but I didn't spend a lot of time down there either, you know? But I did in my younger years view the military, and mainly because a lot of the people I saw go into it were just, they were lost and needed some sense of direction. And to me, I was like, well, I kind of know where I'm going. And so I almost viewed it as like a way out, like, oh, you're going to go allow somebody to do something to tell you exactly what to do. Right. And now I'm like, man, I wish I would have done, like, you know, 4 years at least, you know, and have that under my belt, and who knows where I'd be, you know, from then. And one of my best friends, which you met at the chill room, Fernando, I mean, he's loved it. You know, he's been in the Air Force. I think he retires here in like the next 4 or 5 years. But what was your first thought where, like, I might join the military?
Well, I grew up in the Navy. I trained with the Army, and then I spent 29 years Air Force.
What do you mean you grew up in the Navy? Like you had parents that were in the Navy or? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. My family is military. It's one of the conundrums that the nation's facing at the moment. Nowadays, in fact, when I went through Air War College, they sent us, one of the classes we had was what they called the Rise of the Warrior class. Mm-hmm. And the propensity to serve is changing. There's a lot of segments of American society where being a military member is completely socially inappropriate.
Yeah, sure.
Academia, yeah, for the most part, don't like military. My in-laws are not a fan of the military.
Ah.
They had a moral discussion over the Thanksgiving table when my husband told them he was going to the Air Force Academy.
Nice.
It's are you called to serve? What do you feel about it? And there's a whole lot of misperceptions now. They didn't exist when I was young. When I was a kid, Vietnam was going on when I was young.
Gotcha, yeah.
We all knew someone who was in the military. One of my friend's fathers died in Vietnam. We all knew when I was growing up, I grew up on a military base. We all knew if the guy in the dark suit showed up at your front door, your dad wasn't coming
mm-hmm.
home. We all knew that. And so it was a different mindset. It was a different frame of reference. Nowadays, there are a lot of people who have never met a military member, who know no one in the military. Hollywood has fed us a lot of trope about the military. Yeah. I can't stand watching a lot of war flicks.
Yeah.
Just because you sit there and go, no, no, that's not what it is. The perception that the military is a bunch of mindless drones. We go through training every single year. You must disobey an illegal order. You're never exempt from not thinking. People think, oh, it's just mindless following. No, you have to use your brains.
Yeah.
And when you have somebody who says, oh, yeah, well, I'm just going to do it. No, use your brains. That's what it's there for. It's not just a spacer holding your ears apart. Try again. But there's so many misperceptions about military and military service. As far as experience goes, a lot of ladies and gentlemen find the time in the service invaluable. It gives you a chance to learn who you are. What will you do under pressure?
Mm-hmm.
It also has a chance of making you dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, I was out at Stir Crazy. This is one of the tougher ones that I dealt with, and I ended up apologizing to Lamar Mitchell afterwards. He was the host over at Stir Crazy that mm-hmm. night. And as a military commander, we fall into the category of never forget.
Okay.
Well, I get on stage, I'm doing a set at one of the book spots at Stir Crazy Open Mic, and I take the mic from him and I said, give it up for your host, Andre. Stopped, about smacked myself in the face and went, Lamar Mitchell. Had to apologize to Lamar afterwards because Andre Mitchell was the young man, he was a specialist, and his was the last body that I brought out of Iraq.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, the last C-130 flight, we diverted from Baghdad up to Mosul, and 2 a.m, shadow-filled C-130 cargo bay, and his buddies are carrying his body on.
Mm-hmm.
They strap his transfer case to the floor. I was the troop commander, so was responsible for returning his remains to the United States.
Man.
And in that moment and going, okay, you know, what caused that? Why do I need to really focus on what I'm doing? And so that's still part of me out there and going, okay, something to know. Part of my past still transitions over.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You see a lot of our military comics here. We've got a comedy show coming up called Top Brass.
Yeah.
Going to be June 7th, Tempe Center for the Arts. And we've got most of our military veterans who are comics.
Yeah.
Going to be on that lineup.
Heck yeah.
We've got Sid Smith, Matt Broom, Josh Harrison, Philip Jewell, Jason Santiago. It's going to be one heck of a lineup.
Yeah.
And you'll find a different set of humor there. It's things that don't necessarily translate.
Mm-hmm.
Military life is one of the biggest unrecognized minorities in America. Military brats.
Yeah.
You know, we used to joke about, you know, there actually is a definition, the legitimate offspring of military personnel, thought to be precocious, ubiquitous, underfoot, and insubordinate. But it's a different way of life. And most people don't understand that. A few years ago, we had a couple civilian ladies wanted to declare the term brat an insult.
Okay.
It's not. We're very proud of it. They got told off.
Yeah, you own it. Yeah, at that point. Yeah, we are brats.
We are brats. That is the definition of a military dependent who is a child. Also self-loading cargo. Yeah. We will move ourselves.
Nice.
But it's one where you can learn a lot about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn a lot about what you value. The, I forget which group it was. They did a lot of songs. I'm forgetting which group. This is bad. They did a whole lot of songs that were basically anti-America, bashing America. Then they toured Russia and came back and did a pro-U.S.
Nice.
And somebody said, well, what happened? They went, we got our eyes open to what the rest of the world is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, how do you balance that? You know, I became a comic. And truly, I was in the Pentagon when I said I was going to be a stand-up comic.
Nice.
That is still, to this day, the biggest scream of laughter I've ever gotten.
From all your Pentagon co-workers? What are they called? I don't think you can call someone that works in the Pentagon a co-worker. What are they? Actually, fellow agents? What are they?
Actually, they are co-workers, fellow military. I worked for both National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and United States Air Force while I was at the Pentagon. I did three different tours there. And you are co-workers.
Yeah.
And so they brought all of us in because they do send us to training, trying to teach us how to be civilians.
Yeah, nice.
It didn't work real well. But they said, what are you going to be when you grow up? And my answer was a stand-up comic.
Nice.
And that got a scream of laughter out of the place.
Did you report them to HR?
I think that might have been HR, actually.
All right, nice. So why the Air Force instead of the Navy if you've maybe had like a built-in, you know, you had some weight behind you, I guess, if you would have gone into the military? Or maybe that would have added extra scrutiny, right?
Actually, my military heritage is all enlisted. My whole family is enlisted.
Gotcha.
I am the disgrace of my family. I'm the only commissioned officer.
Uh-huh.
Actually, one, my great uncle from World War II, Walter Rau, he actually started out as enlisted. He became what was known as a Mustang. He got commissioned, was a bombardier in World War II,
mm-hmm.
never made it home. 3 weeks after arriving on station, they were taking off for a night mission out of Stinara, Italy, going up to bomb the coast of France. And his aircraft, he was the bombardier, mm-hmm. so his aircraft crashed on takeoff. The entire crew was killed.
Whoa.
Yeah. My aunt was fairly newly wed, did not know she was 3 weeks pregnant when he died.
Oh, dang.
Yep. So... he was the only other officer in my family. Most of my family is Navy enlisted. 30 mm-hmm. years is expected. I served 29 years Air Force. And of course, the response is, I hate a quitter. Where's the other one?
Oh, wait, hold on. You see, you were 1 year shy?
Yep. And
that comedy bug is strong.
And when I grew up in the Navy, it's not Navy tradition. It was sailor's tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Women on ships are bad luck.
Okay.
The only woman who's not is the captain's wife. So I grew up listening to three girls, no sons, and all sorts of sailor's trope.
Yeah.
And when I told my dad I was going in the service, he says, would you think about going in the Navy? I said, for half a second, and the answer is no.
Yeah, nice.
So I started training with the Army, and the guy says, yeah, you can do anything in the Army. I did about 6 months there, and it was, you can do anything in the Army. You can be infantry. No. You can be artillery. No. You can be armor. No. 10 minutes of that, I joined the Air Force. And the issue was women were not allowed in combat. Now, women have been in combat since time immemorable.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
But legally, in the United States, women were discriminated against and not allowed to serve in combat roles.
Uh-huh.
That changed in 1994.
Wow, that recent?
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
Yep. And that wasn't even all of them. The stipulation for doing special operations was still in effect. I forget what year that finally changed.
2001?
Probably close to. No, it was a little later than that. It was a little later than that. Because in 1996, my commander came and got me. He says, hey, they opened combat control officers. They're looking for combat control officers. You need to apply. I said, sir, that's not funny. He says, why? They now allow women in combat. I said, with the exception of those roles. So that was a bit of a sticking point. Women are now allowed in all the roles. Can you do the job? That's the only question.
Gotcha.
And it's one of the things, you know, going back to comedy on this, when we go on stage, what are we going on stage as? I know there's all sorts of different perspectives on it. Respect to anybody who's got a different perspective, but when you go on stage, how do you go on stage? I go on stage as a comic. Judge me as a comic.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to say I'm a female comic, if you have to go over my race, ethnicity, or anything else,
yeah,
I'm going to say you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Judge me as a comic. Can I hold my own as a comic?
Yeah.
Everything else is incidental. It happens to be there.
Yes.
But
yes.
How many times have I walked on stage and had somebody go, are you ready for a female comic?
No, all the time, I'm sure.
The female got nothing to do with it.
See, I pull out your swinging dick. There it is.
Oh, heck, I still have the biggest one in the place.
Here you go. Swagger. So you went into the Air Force, where at this point was like maybe being a pilot on your mind, like I want to fly some of these badass jets, or was it mainly, hey, I want to serve my country and this seems like the most ideal, you know, venture at this point?
Well, the goal was, first off, I wanted to serve. Mm-hmm. I absolutely wanted to serve. The second one off was, okay, if I can be in the Air Force, fantastic. If not, Army, whatever. Third thing was, I want to fly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the time, I'm nearsighted. I've got very minor vision impairment. They weren't training pilots. They had 200 pilot slots that year. So, okay, I can still serve. I can still be in the Air Force. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Did blind man's UPT. That was what we called it that year. I went to intel school.
Oh, got you.
Which, okay, you know, was that a better career choice for me? Quite possibly.
Yeah.
So we all make jokes about, you know, being an intel officer is very much like being in medieval court.
Okay.
Because you go into one of these big meetings, at the head of the table, you got the general officer.
Yep.
He's the king.
Yeah.
Next to him, you've got, you know, the duke who's in charge of all the baron's knights, i.e. his squadron commanders. And then you've got the officer who's in charge of all the king's steeds, the maintenance officer. And then you got the lesser lords and ladies of the court sitting around the outside. But you can't start court without the entertainment, so bring on intel, the court jester.
Ah, nice. Was there a moment, so would you almost practice or be like a practicing advisor at that point? Or were you just literally, here's your information, blah?
It's analyze the threat, analyze the situation, and figure out, you know, what's the best courses of action.
Mm-hmm.
You can advise. It's rarely a decision, because in the case of, I started out doing tactical airlift. Well, I started out doing, I worked at the Space Warfare Center for a little while. And then I turned around and did tactical airlift. So the C-130, the smaller cargo aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at what is out there, what could possibly cause mission failure. It's up to the pilot to make a decision whether he's going to take that advice or not.
Gotcha.
So we used to joke that it's either an op success or an intel failure.
Oh, nice. Of course, of course. Was there a time, a moment, or a scenario where they were going against maybe what you thought was the correct move and you advocated for your angle and you got them to turn? Or was it like, how much of it is just like, well, this is what kind of what we have in our mind, but we have to hear all voices?
Well, you know, there's so many different scenarios. There's so many different situations. And who is this?
Well, this is Chubbs. He was missing from Friday night to Saturday night.
Okay, Chubbs, where'd you go hiding?
I don't know. He went around the neighborhood or something, but he's not going outside for a few days now.
You're in the penalty box there, fuzzball.
Well, especially because Sheila was out of town. So her uncle just passed, and he served in Vietnam. And he, this last like 8 months, just the fallout from Agent Orange just led him into dementia and went south like super fast.
Mm.
Anyways, he just passed away. So she's out of town. So I'm, you know, here with the cat and I'm talking to my tax guy and I have the door open because we let him outside.
Uh-huh.
It must have been like 2.5 hours. I'm like, I got to go to sleep now. So I like peek out there. I don't see him. I was like, maybe he went inside because he likes to hide. So I close the door, kind of look for him a little bit. I was like, I'm tired. I'll see him in the morning. So I get up in the morning, don't see him at all. And I was running late already. I go outside. I don't see him at all. I'm like, oh my gosh, now I'm freaking out. Now I was like, she's out of town for her uncle's funeral. Do I even burden her with this information? And so I was like, no, I'll just come back on my lunch break. So I'm on my way back from my lunch break, and she's asking me how the day's going. I was like, hey, I just gotta let you know, Chubbs is missing. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I feel guilty. It happened on my watch. And she's playing it cool. She's like, yeah, don't, worry about it. I'm sure he's fine. Just put some, make sure there's water and food outside, and maybe throw out some tuna, 'cause he really loves it. So I'm here for my lunch break, wait, like a half hour, nothing. So go back to work. And then, I come back, still nothing. And now I'm just like, dude, I got this roast to prepare for tonight. And I'm just like stressing like crazy. And so I'm like, well, he's not here. I'm gonna leave for the roast. And who knows what the rest of the day holds, because the following day Sheila's coming back. So I was like, I'm talking to her. Like, we're going to flyer the whole neighborhood. We're going to knock door to door. We're going to get him. And and so I go do the roast, and I get home, and I'm on the phone with her, and she's like, well, I can't hang up with you until, I know that he's not there or that he's there. So I go outside, and I'm just like, calling him, nothing. And then I see this little pair of eyes peek up from this little bin. And I was like, I know I checked that bin like 30 times. I know you just got back. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? You're freaking me out. Get out. And he jumps out, and he's dirty as can be. I'm just like, where you been? But crisis averted, man. Yeah, oh, yeah. That was, all the rom-com scenarios obviously go through my head. Do I get another cat? Do I? No. But yeah, he's a feisty little boy, and we love him. And so I'm glad you're not allergic. That was one of the things I asked you about. It's like, if we're going to film here, do you have a cat? Do you own any pets?
Actually, my husband and I have two cats.
Oh, nice.
So
okay.
They got abandoned down at the park where I work, so both of them are now home permanently.
Nice.
And our big orange fuzzball, actually, I've been doing a bunch of cleanup of old paperwork and shredding stuff, and I heard this mass clamor, and I look over. Yeah, the big fuzzy orange cat bailed up into a box of shred.
Oh, damn.
And so I spent part of last night trying to comb the shred out of a cat.
You so. Those fluffers, man, like that. Oh, I forgot how cute you were. Since you were missing. What are their names?
It's Doc and Louie.
Doc and Louie. Any background to those? Or
Doc is actually named for Dr. Jones or Indiana Jones.
Okay.
Because I was out working in the Rose Garden one day, downtown Phoenix, down at Heritage Square, and the valet from Pizzeria Bianco comes over, and shout out to Carlos on this one.
Carlos.
Yeah, he came over and he says, last night, guy drove in, two guys got out of the vehicle, pulled out two cat crates and dumped two cats. He says, so there's a little brown tabby and a big fluffy orange one. Okay, good to know. Trying to track him down. Well, I finally see the little brown tabby.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I'm working in one of the gardens and I hear this squeak, and I see this, what is the equivalent of a teenage cat, big long legs, tripping over his own feet. And he comes just flying across, bails up on my lap, and I called my husband. I was like, I think I've been adopted.
Oh, nice.
So Louie came home, but I'd never seen the big orange cat. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen him. And a few weeks later, Carlos comes and gets me. He says, I swear to God, the last 2 days I've heard crying in the storm drain. I said, well, all the community cats are accounted for. I saw all of them last night. The only one I can't account for is the big fluffy orange one you guys told me about. I've never seen him.
Yeah.
He lifted the storm drain lid off, and that thing is, it's the size of a freaking truck wheel.
Yeah.
It's a metal rim. It is full of concrete.
Yeah.
I don't see how this guy managed to lift that thing, but he did.
Dang.
And there's the missing orange cat. We had to call animal rescue. It was a 14-foot straight down drop.
Ooh.
Into the storm drain. I'm looking at him and it's like, yeah, Dr. Jones, what are you doing in such a nasty place? So animal rescue sent a live trap. We tied it off on ropes and, put the lid back on the storm drain. A few hours later, went back. Carlos pulls that lid back off, and we're pulling this cat out of the storm drain in a live trap.
Nice.
So we hooked him out and called animal control so they could come get their equipment. And he said, hey, do we need to get him?
Mm-hmm.
He's like, nah, he's coming home. He's adopted.
Nice.
So he and his little brother are back together.
Excellent. What a great story. Man, I had to ask Sheila how she got Chubbs. I think it was just a family. Nothing is cool. That's fine. We love them. We love them. Do you feel you always gravitate more towards cats than dogs, or?
I grew up with cats. I'm actually scared of dogs.
Oh, okay. Any reason in particular?
My sister had a St. Bernard puppy when I started walking when I was 9 months old.
Yeah.
And the St. Bernard puppy thought I was a toy.
Oh.
And so between getting knocked down, dragged around, I have a very bad fear of dogs.
Yeah.
And it was so bad that the first time I went on temporary duty with the Air Force, mm-hmm. we were at the security forces dog pit, and I asked them to throw me in the dog pit.
Ooh.
Because, wow. I'm sorry, being scared of dogs at 21 is embarrassing. At least it was for me.
Yeah.
So they had me put on the padded suit and went, okay, are you sure about this? You cannot run. You have to stand down a dog attack. And sure enough, full bore German Shepherd dog attack. You offer them your arm, they latch in, and you get the full weight of that dog hitting you.
So are you in a full uniform, or is it just the arm?
I'm pretty sure it was the... You know what? I'm not sure anymore.
Yeah.
I don't remember if it was the full padded outfit or if it was just the arm pads, but I remember that dog hit my arm, and it's like, nope, you've got to face your fear.
Yeah.
You cannot go through life absolutely terrified of dogs.
That's true.
And so, yeah, that was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
I can be around dogs now. Prefer not to be.
For sure.
But it's one where it's like, okay, I'm not going to freak out just because there's a dog around.
Yeah, yeah, you've mitigated a little bit of that fear by, you know, giving yourself a little bit of that antivenom, that, you know, vaccine of that experience. Yeah, we all have those fears. It's just you become a little bit more courageous with how you're going to handle it in the situation, right?
Yeah, it becomes a, okay, is this going to control me, or am I going to control it?
Mm-hmm.
And stand it down.
Man, yeah, I've been bit by a couple dogs, but... Yeah, never fully gained like this whole, yeah, that a whole fear of them in that sense. I mean, you know, if there's a big dog around you, for sure, you know what they're capable of, right? And yeah. So, you know, there is some respect there. That is something that we always try to convey. Don't worry, buddy, I'm respecting you. I'm respecting your area. Oh, for sure. So were you piloting some of these aircraft, or were you just like the commanding officer? I don't know how this works, so yeah. Apologies for my ignorance.
Was not a pilot in the Air Force. I was a pilot on the civil side. You know, did through cross country solo, and also flew hang gliders for quite a while. Flew sailplanes.
What do you mean, did cross country solo? Like Amelia Earhart type stuff?
Yeah, basically a small civil aircraft, and you know, took it out flying. I have actually landed an aircraft at the second tallest airport in the world,
Leadville,
Colorado.
Dang.
So that was years ago.
Yeah.
And then I flew hang gliders for a while. I flew sailplanes for a while.
Nice.
You know, it's encountered a photo the other day. Full disclosure, I bribed a tram driver. If you've ever been in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Sandia Pink tram.
No, I haven't.
I bribed the tram driver back when I was 22 or 23.
Statute of limitations. Okay.
To ride on top of that tram.
Nice.
So yeah, it was high winds. Not the smartest thing I've ever done.
Okay, so what's the dumbest thing you've ever done at this point?
Oh God, the dumbest thing. The list is long and distinguished.
Yes, I guess dumbest and like most thrill seeking, like for like that purpose, like just a adrenaline junkie.
Well, I have always been an adrenaline junkie. So my squadron commander actually sent me to my group commander. I was a hang glider pilot. I did whitewater rafting. I was a bungee jumper through stunt jumps. I flew sailplanes. I flew hang gliders. I've been skydiving. I've hiked erupting volcanoes. I've been a scuba diver up through rescue diver.
Damn.
That's... My squadron commander looked at me and went, "You're a safety hazard. Go talk to the group commander."
Nice.
I had to get permission to do all those. So the strange thing is you can do almost anything if you do it safely. I'm not going to string up my own bungee cords.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not going to do it.
Yeah.
But I will jump through places that are certified.
Mm-hmm.
Hang glider? Yeah, I'll set up my own hang glider. I don't trust anybody else to set up a hang glider.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's... Yeah, you see people that it's like, you see some of the accidents and it's like somebody...
What do you mainly look out for?
the big thing is airworthiness. Make sure your equipment is good to go. Make sure that your hang straps are good to go. Make sure that the sailcloth is good to go. Don't have a bent frame. Don't fly something that's not airworthy.
Mm-hmm.
If you're packing a parachute, make sure you do it correctly. You know, paying attention to what you're doing, making sure your equipment is actually still sound.
Yeah.
You can do almost anything, and you can do most things safely. The what would be the craziest thing I've ever done?
Other than join the military and get married and, you know, and do stand up and put on your own shows.
I'm going to have to think about what the craziest thing is I've ever done. The stupidest thing that I've ever done.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Not necessarily the stupidest thing I've ever done, but I was trying to get rid of my husband and I were watching a movie one night.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting there watching a movie, and my mother-in-law is being a pain in the ass, and she's calling in because she knows it's date night. So she's calling in the middle of this, and she's done it multiple times.
I'm sorry, Liz. What a bitch.
Like I said, just to give you a little frame of reference, the first time I went home with my husband after we were married was Thanksgiving with his family. And I am socially unacceptable to his family.
Yeah.
We got married under protest. Both of our families protested.
Wow.
My mother threatened not to show up. She refused to pin my wedding veil on me. He and I actually eloped. We got married in battle dress combat boots. He was in flight suit and combat boots.
Badass.
And then because my mom would not recognize a civil match, we had a religious ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And the family showed up for the religious ceremony. And it was... That was one for the books.
Does anybody like to object? the wave.
Yeah, the whole damn congregation stands up. Wow. But so we were married under protest. We had three ministers refuse to marry us.
And crazy.
Yeah. There's no love lost. The first time he brought me home, she introduced me to the not one but two young ladies she would have preferred to be his wife.
Oh, wow.
Face to face. No kidding. I'm gonna be having dinner with these two. So that's the type of relationship it was.
Yeah, but what hoops you had to jump through to just maintain like your own like, you know, respect for yourself and your self-worth and all that. Like, my hat's off to you, girl, man. Damn.
Well, there's a point at which, because I had been raised to be a good daughter-in-law. I had been trained to be a good daughter-in-law.
Yeah.
But there's a point at which you just go, you know what? You've mistaken my kindness for weakness long enough.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, I was fed up, and she's yet again disturbing, you know, just, we're sitting there watching a movie, and I yell at the top of my lungs, "Damn it, Carol, you're disrupting sex." And she hung up the phone and never called us.
Woo! Yes.
101 ways to get rid of your mother-in-law.
Damn. That's number 69. Hey, oh man. So hold on. So are your guys' parents still married?
My mother died the day after Christmas, so okay. she died just recently. My dad and her had been married for 58 years.
Wow. Okay.
My mother-in-law is part of my comedy set. My mother-in-law's had four husbands. Three of them were hers.
Yeah. So I'm gonna say, I'm gonna say you guys are going on 31 strong. There you go. Like,
yeah, she's currently living in Costa Rica with a man who is married to somebody else, but it's a Catholic country. He can't get a divorce. Their business, not my concern.
Yeah.
Although it is good comedy material.
Yeah, that's great, man. That is great. So, all right. So that line that you use, is that the stupidest thing that you did? Because I know I took you away from saying that.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily the stupidest thing I've done. It's probably one of the most inappropriate things I've ever said to somebody.
Yeah. So. Oh, that's great. That's great. I don't know. I think that's... that's just the comic in me, though. I just see, like, yeah, that's something I would like get somebody off the phone, like, yo, you know. But also, it's like we have the difference in age, you know, all sex, all that. Yeah, that's wild. I love that. That's probably gonna be the thumbnail to this episode.
Outstanding.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Let's see. Okay, so you've done just about like you've done like five things on my bucket list. Like, I need to do scuba diving, you know, skydiving. Those are my main two for sure. Are you pretty proficient with like firearms?
I'm an expert markswoman. Okay, let me tell you about a bad day at the range.
Ooh.
You know, and
don't shoot yourself in the foot.
I had the worst day at the range one time. I, breathing pattern off. I couldn't hit the broadside of a barn to save my life. Mm-hmm. I was firing an M16 that day. And the problem was my shot pattern was all low and central.
Okay.
And that meant that the range master comes up, takes one look and goes, well, it's not center of mass, but you'll stop your target.
Oh, nice.
The next day we get out there, and like I said, the day before I couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. I used to be a government courier. So trained, standard shot pattern for us is 2 to the chest, 1 to the head.
Yes. Okay.
And so the next day we're out at the range, and the day before, same range. The previous day was M16. Now it's 9 mil. And they start out, okay, first round, first series, 2 to the chest, 1 to the head. Mine were drilled overlapping center mass.
Yeah.
And dead center through the forehead.
Dang, the next day.
The next day.
What changed?
One day I couldn't hit the broadside of the barn, and the next day, flat out.
What changed, Liz?
Well, like I said, I was trained as part of my job was I was a government courier. So. Yeah.
So as a courier, are you transferring just objects, documents, or is it also like, you know, important personnel?
I used to do document transport. I also did prisoner transport once. It was a bad day. I had a biohazard package. I had a classified courier package. And I had a prisoner.
Is this all stateside or is this overseas?
This was overseas.
Oh, okay. All right. Now in my mind, that's different. Because I was thinking over stateside.
When I started as a government courier, I was stateside.
Yeah.
That was between two posts.
Gotcha.
That was actually the whole reason I was a government courier. We didn't have computers at that time.
Oh, shit, girl.
where I was working at. We actually brought in the first computers to the location I was working at.
Dang. How big were they? Or is it just that there was no means for, you know, the optical cables and whatnot?
Yeah, it was a fairly new installation at the time.
Yeah, gotcha. So. So our assumptions that you've been under gunfire, incense, and all that.
I have taken incoming.
Yeah.
There's nothing like waking up to an explosion, a mass clattering, and walk outside, grab a handful of shrapnel, walked into work that day, threw it across the sergeant first class's desk. She looks at me, she says, ma'am, what's that? I said, that's what hit my hooch last night. Thank God I wasn't outside, because I'd have been a massive bloody pulp at that time.
Yeah, for reals. So I've heard a statistic, or I've heard people say that has served as well. And I think it was Jocko Willink. Had mentioned that PTSD numbers through members that served seem to be lower when it comes to like SEALs and higher tactical personnel, mainly because they're kind of going into the situation. There's a game plan. We go in, get out. We're in control here in this sense, versus your standard personnel are just kind of sitting, waiting guard, waiting for something to happen. Next thing you know, you got fire, you know, incoming fire. And so there's that. We don't know what's going on. We don't know where it's coming from, where it seems. So PTSD in those individuals seems to be higher because of the unknown, right? The anxiety of that versus when you're going in, you know what to expect. Per se, you know, there's no telling when stuff actually pops off, but what's your experience with it? Maybe individuals you served with and maybe your own history with it.
I don't have PTSD.
That's amazing.
Well, here's the bizarre thing about it. I love what General Mad Dog Maddox comment on it. He says, everybody who goes into combat, you're going to experience stress.
Yeah, of course.
You're going to experience stress. Can you handle it or not? Okay, war zone to me. I'm actually more comfortable in a war zone than I am back here in the United States.
Yeah.
That's the anomaly. That's, you know, for a lot of our veterans, there's a vividness to life in the military.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
Where everything you do matters, where lives are on the line,
mm-hmm.
safety's on the line, you know, whatever it is, there is something you're risking something.
Yeah.
And so you come back to the United States and you go, I've got somebody complaining that they were offended.
Yeah, yeah.
They're hurt. They're offended. They say, I raised my voice to them. I had a boss who said that I said something profane. She didn't tell me that. She told some of my coworkers that, mm-hmm. that I had shouted profanity at her.
Yeah.
Where does this come from? No. And anyway, grow up, get over it. But there are those veterans who do have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in World War I, they called them the ragman. They got the 100-mile stare. They're just, the lights are on, ain't nobody home.
Yeah.
You got the Vietnam vets who dealt with it. You see, you know, the social stigma of it. So they tried to destigmatize it. But then there's also the, okay, how much are we setting up the expectation in young recruits that, oh yeah, you're going to go to the war zone, you're going to get PTSD.
Yeah, that's true, right?
And you look at it and go, okay, the better trained you are, the more that you are trained, taught, and you are taught how to handle this, the better chance you are of coming through it without the psychological wounds.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have ladies and gentlemen who have sustained those psychological wounds.
Yeah.
How do you treat that? How do you keep them, you know, recovering, on the path to recovery? And for individuals that I have dealt who have had it, one of them says, you know, I just want to go back to where I was prior to.
Yeah. Well,
this is a bridge you can't uncross.
Yeah, for sure.
You got to get those wounds cleaned up. You got to get them healed up. So now you might have some scars, and the scars may well be unsightly. But scars are the badges of the survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we normalize, heal from this? This is not, you're stagnant. Get your momentum going. Get yourself healed back up. Press on. There's more to life.
Yeah. Well, not only that, too. Somebody walking the footsteps that you just walked is going to need your advice from you going through what they're going to experience. So if they can see your scars, or they know that you've been through that, or you see that they're going through it, you can say, hey, I've been where you've been, and this is what helped me. And that's why you want to dig yourself out of that hole that you might find yourself in, so you can be, you know, the advisor to the person right behind you that's going to be going through what you've gone through.
Yeah. And it gets a little strange in the stand-up comedy, because when I first came to Phoenix, Sid Smith was laughing at me. He says, oh my God, you're going to unionize the comics.
Yeah.
I said, no, not my job. Not
yeah,
my
right.
job. But you know, he was a Navy Intel guy.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that gets brought up, and he says, you were in 29 years, you were a commander. And he knew exactly what that meant. And so the problem of the instincts of how to act when, okay, I see a suicidal ideation on Facebook, I'm probably calling the comic.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
In the military, it's an automatic refer somebody, get them the treatment they need. In stand-up comedy, you know, have I been cussed out before? Yeah. Have I dealt with profanity out of comics? Yeah. Have I had a comic send me a dick pic in anger once? Yeah.
Jesus.
This is stuff that in the military I would never see. I would never deal with this. Back here, I'm surprised at some of, you know, it's, and for me, it's like, okay, it's a different frame of reference. It's like, can I help someone out? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. If somebody doesn't want help, there's nothing I can do. They're a legal adult. It's
yeah,
their business.
For sure.
In the military, the standard of care for your troops, tending to a troop, people talk about, oh yeah, you're taught to care for people. Well, it's care about, it's caring for.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the touchy-feely everybody thinks.
Yeah.
It's the, what is in this troop's best interest?
Yeah.
If they're struggling that much, do you get them, you know, how do you get them treatment? In stand-up comedy, we deal with it on a fairly regular basis. The mental illness, the substance abuse. You know, if a comic is going to run hell for leather over the edge of the cliff, there's not much we can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody asked me, well, why do you... I was sitting out in front of... It was actually sitting in front of a Guitar Center.
Yeah.
The one just off of I-10.
Yeah.
I was sitting out in front of that doing a suicidal intervention on a comic who had been lashing out at another comic, because when people hurt, they start hurting others.
Yes.
And so trying to talk the one down, I told the one, it's like, listen, I don't think this individual, this is not like this person.
Mm-hmm.
My suspicion is there's something else going on here. I said, I'm going to apologize to you. Let me call this individual. see if they will agree to stop lashing out at you. Well, I called the individual up. The individual's best friend had just died.
Yeah.
And they were suicidal. And I'm sitting in front of Guitar Center going, I'm here for an SM58. Okay, well, guess what? That plan is now on hiatus. And somebody said, well, you know, why do you do that? It's because I'm trained to. I have to unlearn that. But then I had to stop myself and go, is that something I want to unlearn?
No, you don't.
And so it's that balance, the what is appropriate in the civilian community. I've had comics go, you're nuts. Why are you wasting your time? Because that's somebody on that's somebody's life on the line.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, what do you do with that?
Yeah, I mean, there's that, why are you wasting time? I mean, any, you can say that about anything at that point. Like, why are you on the stage? Why are you wasting your time? Why are you, you know, going into work? You're going to die eventually. Why are you wasting your time? Like, you can say that about anything. No, you do have to care for folks. And caring for folks also is telling them exactly what they need to hear, which might is most of the time not that what they want to hear. Yeah. And it's not going to sugarcoat anything. You're not going to be nice, but you're being kind to them by addressing, mm-hmm. you know, an issue that needs to be, you know, looked at more carefully and take, being actionable at that point. You have to. And you see that all the time with comics. And it's like, at what point is it part of their act and who they're trying to be? And what point is this? No, this is a real, you know, cry for help, essentially. Because if you're voicing that, you want somebody to step in. You want somebody to step in. If you're voicing it, in my opinion, you know, it's you're playing it off like you don't. You're playing it off like, I'm just going to do it. You know, but no, you want somebody to step in and hold you back from it.
Yeah, and it's one where, you know, obviously we do have the gamut, you know, and you'll see this wherever you go. And looking at what are the ways to get people help that they need. You know, there's one comic I said, okay, they asked, they were going to have themselves committed. And it's like, okay, you recognize this. I said, do I need to come get you? Do I need to come get you? And they said, no, not right now. But if you do, leave your cell phone on, because if you do, in the military, you never leave a suicidal individual alone. You never do. So it's very disconcerting to see that aspect of it. And then, like I said, you know, okay, there's some that there's just nothing I can do to help.
Yeah,
I've called in wellness checks before on comics. I've gone searching for comics before.
Yeah.
And the realization that the tools that I had in the military to help someone are not there in the civilian community.
Yeah.
Or it's a case of, I can request this. We had one where we had a young comic that did a suicidal ideation. I was actually out in California, and it came up on a Facebook page, and somebody, I forget if that was the one where somebody called me and went, can you find this person?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd called, we had a mutual supervisor for Dinner Detective, and started trying to track her down, sent a wellness check to her last known location. Turned out she had gone out on a cruise and had sent a suicidal ideation right before she left, and then turned off her cell phone and then went on a cruise.
Come on.
So that I'm furious about, because she knew it was going to happen. And if you want to do that type of cry for help, don't be wasting the police officer's time. Don't be wasting the suicide hotline's time. Don't waste my time.
Mm-hmm.
There are other individuals who need that.
Yeah.
But this one wanted to raise some drama and managed to do so.
Jesus. Jesus.
But, you know, how do we help people heal up and experience some success? I'm sorry, this just took a really dark turn.
I love it, though. I like it. I just, where it goes is where it goes, Liz. There's no complaints here. No, and that is something that needs to get talked about too, you know, and addressed, and, you know, be taken seriously. And we need to keep an eye out for it, you know, because, like you said, we're a community, and we have to, like, look out for each other, support each other, and take each other seriously. You know, if you're gonna say certain things, like, we gotta, hey, is this really what you're feeling? Is this really what you're going through? Or, you know, do you just need some companionship of some sort right now to try and vent out and all of that? Yeah, no, you have to. And that is very accurate in your end, where it's like your previous experience with this was, I'll just get handled. They have to obey my orders. They have to, you know, follow the processes because they are, you know, a government employee at that point. And now you're in the civilian world, and that's the freedoms that people realize that they don't have, or that they do have, that they think they did, that they don't. It's like you're free to live however you want, even if you are a danger to yourself. You are.
Actually, there's two cases where the only way that somebody will get, I used to be an EMT a long time ago, and we had what they call SCIP. That's actually the psychiatric part of the hospital. And if somebody was a threat to themselves or anybody around them at that time, you could have them put into the system for 3 days just to make sure that they weren't going to go postal on someone, mm-hmm. Or that they weren't going to off themselves. A lot of these ladies and gentlemen, they know exactly what to say to avoid it or to get put in. You see both directions. It's a little strange.
Yeah.
I was out in Iraq. It's 3 a.m. We had done a massive generator swap, and one of the security guards came and got me. He says, ma'am, we got a jumper, and you're senior ranked on station. Doesn't matter. Up 3 stories. If you ever see PC2, what they call the Perfume Palace, it's where we were working mm-hmm. at. 3 stories up, and security managed to get the guy back inside. I'm not law enforcement. I'm not allowed to frisk, so we had to have somebody else. This was a civilian contractor.
Okay.
We had to have security frisk him for weapons. Mm-hmm. And then it's, how do you get him 3 stories down safely? How do you get him over to the medical facility? And as we're walking him out, he says, ma'am, I just wanted some attention. I said, well, sir, you have got my undivided attention. I'm in the middle of a war zone, and I'm dealing with a civilian contractor who's causing problems. Turned out it wasn't the first time he caused problems.
Yeah.
He had 3 previous counts of threatening his coworkers. And my only question to the company was, why the hell did you put this man in the middle of a war zone? You knew he was a problem.
Liability.
You sent him out here. That pissed me off. It's like, if he is that unstable, he should not be here, and you knew it. Mm-hmm. And you sent him anyway. So now I have to deal with him. So we get him squared away, get him to his, you know, down to the medical. And I sent my husband an email after that. And it's like, God damn it, it's 3 a.m. It's like, I haven't even had my coffee, and I'm dealing with a suicidal jumper. And God bless my husband. He sends back, suicide and a coffee? You want hash browns with that?
Nice.
Hell yeah, I want hash browns with this.
That is so good. Wow. He knew you. He knows you.
Oh, yeah.
What's your husband's name, by the way?
Scott.
Scott. I'd love to meet him soon.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Liz, that took a little bit of a darker turn, but it's real. It's raw. It's honest. I love just that. You know, I love to just get people behind the mic and just kind of see where it goes and, you know, see what's going around in that head. And I've learned a ton. My admiration for you has grown ever further. What exciting stuff do you have in the works? Because I know you have stuff in the works. You got stuff going on all the time. You just toured with Sandra Reiser, right?
Yeah, Sandra Risser, yep.
Risser.
Yep.
So what do you got for the people so they can follow you?
Oh, goodness. We've got, let's see. We've got Class Clowns coming up this coming Friday at Tempe Center for the Arts. We have got...
What a Class Clowns is...
It is a comedy showcase. This is the one that has seen... I'm actually apprenticed to Tony Visick over at comedyschools.com.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the show that has seen people, no kidding, go from their very first open mic or very first show all the way to national television.
Nice.
So this is the Tomorrow's Comics Today. So that's going to be next Friday at Tempe Center for the Arts.
Okay.
On the 25th, we've got the Clean Comedy Workout out at the Chill Room,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of our open mic comics are learning that clean comedy actually pays very well.
Yep.
So we have had a lot of bookers out there and a lot of our comics getting booked on paid gigs. We have got Joe Wong coming to Tempe Center for the Arts April 26th. Mm-hmm. And then on June 7th, we've got Top Brass. If you ain't got bullets, you got to have balls. It is all the military comics that are a stack of them. Most of the military comics from the Phoenix area will be at Tempe Center for the Arts. And that's June 7th.
Heck yeah. And shout out for Tempe Center of the Arts for, you know, allowing us or working with us to put these events on, right?
Oh, heck yeah. It is a beautiful venue. It's absolutely fantastic. And like I said, you know, there's, as comics go about learning their craft, there's all sorts of things. You'll do the bar shows. You'll do the, you know, you'll, most kids aspire to go to the comedy, you know, the smaller comedy clubs. Mm-hmm. You'll do the big stages. This is a fantastic venue. This is bring your art form. Bring the highest of your craft.
Yeah.
Bring it. It's an incredible audience, incredible venue, and just a fantastic time.
Perfect. Perfect. I appreciate you so much for coming on. I know you've been heavy on Facebook. Instagram is more recent, right? Yep. What are those handles?
It's Liz Frisius. That's F-R-I-S-I-U-S on Facebook. On Instagram, it's Liz.Frisius. Once again, Liz.Frisius.
Beautiful. And I've seen you've been doing TikTok dances. What's that one?
Yeah, just make sure that I've got one of those paper towel dispensers.
There you go, right? Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ton of respect and love for you. Guys, follow Liz and what she's doing. Awesome, awesome things coming and continue growing. I'm going to follow in some of your footsteps here.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. All right, guys. Till next time. Adios.